From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Jackie Spinner about what it's like to be a young woman reporting on the war in Iraq. She spent 9 months covering Iraq for the Washington Post and became the Baghdad bureau chief. While covering the release of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, she was nearly kidnapped. Spinner is a friend of Jill Carroll, the journalist who was kidnapped on January 7th. Also, we discuss how the centrality of Islamic law in Iraq today is affecting the rights of women with Isabel Coleman, a policy analyst at the Council on Foreign Relations. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has some thoughts on the 250th birthday of his favorite composer, Mozart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Iraq is the most dangerous place in the world to be a journalist. My guest Jackie Spinner has written a memoir about covering Iraq for the Washington Post in 2004 and early 2005. She had no war experience when she got there. By the time she left, she was the Post's Baghdad bureau chief. She reported on day-to-day life, car bombs, and the Battle of Fallujah. To better report on the release of prisoners from Abu Ghraib, she spent a night there. Standing in front of the prison, she was nearly kidnapped. Spinner is a friend of Jill Carroll, the journalist who was kidnapped in Iraq on January 7th. Spinner's new memoir is called Tell Them I Didn't Cry. Jackie Spinner, welcome to Fresh Air. What goes through your mind when a journalist is kidnapped or when a journalist is killed in Iraq?
It's very surreal because this is a scenario that all of us in Baghdad have imagined one way or another for ourselves. And particularly in Jill's case, when it's somebody that I know, who's a friend of mine, I mean, I'm just terrified for her. And also can't help but think, gosh, that could have been me.
Does that mean that you dwell on it a lot or that you try your best not to think about it?
A little of both. It's something that you have to remain vigilant about. So whenever you leave your compound or I go out and I report on the streets, I'm constantly thinking about how to keep myself safe so that I'm not kidnapped. In that sense, I do dwell on it. I have to, as a security precaution. At the same time, if you allow yourself to be consumed by the fear, you can't do any work. You can't report any stories.
Did you travel through the streets of Baghdad reporting with Jill Carroll?
We never reported together. We hung out. We worked for separate news organizations, and every news organization has its own security apparatus. I tapped into the Washington Post. She had her own. We traveled a little differently in the sense that I always was in an armored vehicle, certainly in the last year. That was the way that we traveled, and Jill preferred to go much more discreetly so that there wasn't as big of a barrier between her and the Iraqi people.
You know, a lot of people wonder why anyone would take the kind of risk that you need to take in order to report from Iraq, and some people wonder particularly why a woman would take that kind of risk. And I think your book, in part, is the answer to that question. But tell us, why did you want to go to Iraq? You had asked your paper, The Washington Post, repeatedly to let you go and report from there.
Well, I was reporting about Iraq reconstruction contracting for a year right after the war started, and I believed that I was only getting half of the story. I was just convinced that I needed to go to Iraq to see for myself how the money was being spent. And I was desperate to get there. I just didn't feel like I could adequately report the story from Washington. And as you mentioned, I begged my editors to go and convinced them ultimately, for entirely different reasons, that I should go there.
So when you did go to Iraq, I'm wondering how you felt about your family's feelings about it. Here's what I'm thinking. You know, you have a twin sister who was very worried about you. Your father had recently died, so your mother had just, you know, lost her husband. So she must have been very worried about you going. Did that factor into your decision at all?
Originally, it didn't. My family has always supported me in my journalistic endeavors, and I felt that support. Of course, my mother was concerned. My sister told me when I left the first time that if anything happened to me, she would never feel joy again. I carried that with me every day, every minute, every hour that I was in Iraq. I knew what my family would go through if something were to happen. But I think it was only when I got home after the first 9-10 months there that I really realized how selfish I had been to put them through what I had. And I think that it was harder to go back the second time for my second tour, knowing that they were going to be suffering as much as they were.
As a woman in Iraq, were there times when you felt like you were more of a target and other times when you felt like you were less of a target?
I would say for the most part, I felt that I was less of a target in the sense that I could put on a disguise. I learned from our Iraqi staff how to look like an Iraqi woman, how to walk so nobody would notice that I was an American. The very subtle nuances of the culture I learned to adopt so that when I went out on the streets, just as Jill Carroll did, I felt that I had this extra blanket of security because nobody would notice me. I mean, the clothes did what they were intended to do, which is make me anonymous. So I actually felt that it was an advantage being a woman reporter.
I know you could put on the abaya, the full body cloak, and be anonymous, and because you're shrouded, look like an Iraqi woman. But you mentioned the way you walk, the way you carry yourself. How did that change under the hijab?
Well, I learned to look at the ground. You know, if I'm wearing the very conservative Islamic dress, then I needed to also act very conservatively. I didn't look any male in the eye. I learned to wear a lot of makeup because Iraqi women wear heavy makeup. That's not something that I do here in the United States, but I learned to do that, to carry my purse a certain way, to wear the right shoes. It would have been futile to do all of this and to be wearing American shoes. I had Iraqi sandals, very cheap leather that, you know, looked like any woman in Iraq would wear. And my staff reminded me not to smile when I went into public. They said, after all, Iraqis are suffering. You can't be walking around with a big grin on your face. You're going to look like a happy American.
You were nearly kidnapped outside Abu Ghraib prison while you were writing a story for the Washington Post. Let's start with what that story was that you were researching.
I had gone to the prison the night before to cover one of the detainee releases back in the spring and summer of 2004. The United States military was routinely letting hundreds of reformed insurgents, I guess you could call them, go. And we often, as reporters, would just simply stay outside the prison and cover them, the buses rolling out full of the detainees, the former detainees. And I decided that I wanted to be inside. I wanted to see what it was like when they were preparing to leave. I'd spent the night there with a photographer and had watched the buses roll out from the other side. And as I was attempting to leave the prison, I was dressed in my abaya and my headscarf, and I had a very Iraqi-looking bag filled with my gear. And I walked out of the prison, and a man grabbed me by the wrist and started pulling me toward a taxi vehicle. Another man came up and grabbed me around the waist, and they were just dragging me. I don't know exactly what they were planning to do. My guess is they were trying to kidnap me and take me somewhere. Fortunately, the Marines saw from the guard tower what was happening, started shouting, "American down, American down," and they came out and saved my life.
How long do you think it took for them to actually get there?
It probably was a matter of minutes. I would say maybe 2 to 3 minutes. I remember at one point looking up at the guard tower. I was trying not to attract too much attention because there were still hundreds of people outside of the prison waiting for their relatives to come out, and I didn't want to be the center of attention. But I remember gesturing toward the guard tower and sort of frustration. "Come on, guys, you must see what's happening to me. Come get me, come get me." But it felt like an eternity.
Did you scream?
I didn't scream. I really didn't want to attract any attention. I felt that that would have been even worse. And so I was pretty calm. I was trying to negotiate in English, which was probably futile. I do remember when they pulled my abaya. It was, you know, Velcro, and they pulled it off of me. And they saw my flak jacket, my bulletproof vest, and they started saying to me, "CIA, CIA." And I do remember at that point my voice was raised and I said, "No, Washington Post, Washington Post." I didn't want them to think that I was a spy.
I guess I don't really understand why you were so worried about screaming. I mean, not wanting to be the center of attention. This isn't like a self-effacing thing, is it? I mean, your life is at stake here. You're on the verge of being kidnapped. Why not scream?
I just thought that if the crowd saw that these men had an American, that they might have killed me on the spot. I mean, I remember looking over at a woman and sort of making eye contact with her and thinking, okay, woman to woman, you see, I'm a human being. Help me get out of this, you know, intervene. Get me out of the situation. And I have never seen anybody look at me with as much hatred as she did.
Well, one of the many things this makes me wonder is, here you are risking your life to cover the story of the Iraqi people and of the American military and of our involvement as a country there. But part of what you're concerned about is the fate of the Iraqi people. And then you look into eyes like hers as you're on the verge of being kidnapped and she hates you. So how does that make you feel about continuing to risk your life to cover her story?
Well, I understood her hatred. I mean, she wasn't looking at me as Jackie Spinner, the reporter, the American reporter. She was looking at me the same way that she looked at Lindy England, the woman very, you know, well-known in Iraq for the American soldier who was photographed dragging a naked detainee on a leash. She saw me for the reason that she had no electricity, that her children couldn't go to school safely, that she worried about suicide bombers every time she left her house. I mean, I was not human to her. I was every failed promise from the Americans, and I understood her hatred.
My guest is Washington Post reporter Jackie Spinner. Her new memoir is called Tell Them I Didn't Cry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Washington Post reporter Jackie Spinner. She's written a new memoir about reporting from Iraq called Tell Them I Didn't Cry. Let's get back to what was happening to you. You were on the verge of being kidnapped. Finally, the Marines, after about 2 or 3 minutes, they saw what was happening. They rescued you, and the guys who were kidnapping you fled?
They did. They scattered. The minute the Marines ran out, I didn't see them again until I got back inside the prison. And they brought a man to me who they said was the original one who grabbed me by the wrist and asked me if he was the potential kidnapper. I was 98% sure he was the one, but I wasn't 100%. And I was really reluctant to point a finger at him because I thought if he's not an insurgent now, after months in Abu Ghraib for potentially kidnapping this American woman, he will be when he gets out. And I just couldn't do that.
So you said, no, it wasn't?
I said, no, I can't be sure.
Okay, so you get free of the situation, and then what, you go back and you report the story you were initially reporting on, which was the release of prisoners from Abu Ghraib?
I did. I went back inside the prison and eventually got a ride back with the military to Baghdad to our bureau. And that afternoon, I sat down and I wrote the story about the prisoner release and never mentioned what had happened to me that day.
Why didn't you mention it?
Because I didn't think that I should have been part of the story. I mean, once journalists get on the stage, once we become part of the story, it changes the story. And I'm very conscious of the fact that as much fear as I had in Iraq and as much as I dreaded the violence that was aimed at me, the Iraqi people dreaded it too, and they were really the story, not me.
You were reunited with your interpreter after you got free of these kidnappers, and you said to your interpreter, "Tell them I didn't cry." And that's the title of your memoir, "Tell Them I Didn't Cry." Why was that so important?
At the moment, it was really important to me that as much as I was shaking and I knew what had almost happened to me, but I hadn't cried. And at that time, it was a badge of honor. I have to say, my sister protested the title of the book. She thought it was me apologizing as a woman for not having cried and somehow saying that it would have been not okay if I had cried. But I can't really tell you what was going through my head at the time, except that I was very proud of the fact that I had survived this and I hadn't broken down.
it became very difficult for reporters to report in Iraq. And you described some of the things you had to do in order to get the story, particularly at times or in areas where you actually couldn't go out yourself or be on the scene yourself. So tell us some of the ways that you would use the Iraqis who were working with the Washington Post to help you get the stories.
There are numerous ways. I mean, you know, our Iraqi staff, I can't thank them enough. I can't honor them enough for the work that they're doing. They are our eyes and ears. And I say this in the book. They are really our eyes and ears in the country. If there is a car bomb in a neighborhood where it's not only dangerous for me to go as a Westerner, but it's dangerous for an Iraqi translator to be seen with a Westerner, we would often send them on their own, and they would go out and do all of the reporting and come back. And I would sit there and interview them and question them about what they saw and who they talked to and what the people said. And this was a very routine way that we covered a lot of the violence that was happening on the streets. It just wasn't safe enough for us to go together often, and certainly not in the last few months.
I realize how impossible it must have been for you to firsthand get the story each time there was a story to be covered. But did it violate your instincts initially to get a story secondhand like that?
Of course. As a journalist, the entire reason why I do what I do is because I want to be there first. And I want to hear things for myself firsthand. And it was very frustrating not to be able to get out and to do my own reporting. But I also knew that I couldn't do it. I physically could not go to all of the places that I wanted to go to without really endangering myself and endangering the lives of our Iraqi staff. And so I just sort of settled on the fact that this is how we were going to report the Iraq story. It was the way that we had to do it.
Did the Iraqi staff have to keep secret in their neighborhoods what their jobs were?
They do. And to this day, most of our translators have never told their families where they work. Their parents may know, their siblings may know, but aunts and uncles are off limits. Cousins are off limits. Their neighbors don't know where they go every day when they get in their cars and come to our office. Two of our translators have told their neighbors they work at internet cafes, which would explain why they're gone for long periods of time. But no, it's a secret. They can't tell anybody where they work.
One of the stories you covered for the Post was the Battle of Fallujah. In fact, your editor asked you to cover the story, and you were reluctant to because you didn't really want to go into battle to get the story. So did you consider saying no?
I absolutely tried to get out of it. I talked to my editor and asked him if it was wise to send me, mostly because I had never embedded before. I'd never really spent any time with the military for the first 5 months or so that I was in Iraq. I was the street reporter who went out and talked to Iraqis. I was not the military reporter. And I thought that, I would do something either to mess up the story or to get myself killed.
So why did you end up saying yes?
I felt like I didn't have a choice at the end of the day. I didn't want to be seen as a chicken. But when I did get to Fallujah and I realized I had a frontline spot, I think the military thought they were doing the Washington Post a favor by giving us this great spot on the front line. I traded places with another reporter because I wanted to be in the middle. I didn't want to be on the front. I had no desire to be that close to the war. And I had tremendous guilt about that, because I knew that there were reporters who had a lot more guts than I did, but I simply did not want to be that close.
Did your editor have any problem with you trading places?
I never told them. I told them that, and this was true, that I thought it would not be prudent for me to be in a foxhole during the battle. I was only one person for the Washington Post. Our competitors, the New York Times, had 2 to 3 reporters covering the battle. And I thought it was better if I had a broader view of the war. And that's how I justified it to them and to me. And I think it was the right call in the end. I think our stories were better because I was standing over the battlefield and not, at least on the night the battle began, I wasn't right in the thick of things.
I think it was right before you went to Fallujah, when your mother found out that you were being sent to Fallujah on assignment, she called your foreign editor to make sure that you were okay, and you were just appalled. You describe this a little bit in your memoir. So tell us a little bit about why your mother called and what your reaction was.
Well, I've never really talked to her about it directly, because I know that she was probably a little bit embarrassed in retrospect having done that. It was a mother's instinct. My father was in Vietnam, and I think that she was reliving a lot of her anxiety about him being in war when I was in Iraq, just that not knowing what was going to happen. I was appalled. I wigged out. I called my sister, and I said, you would can't believe what Mom did. She called the editor. I think I was afraid of not being taken seriously as a foreign reporter, but after I thought about it for a while, I realized that she must have been absolutely terrified. It was so out of character for her to have done that, and I felt terrible about the anxiety and the angst that she had that would have prompted her to do that.
Jackie Spinner is a reporter for The Washington Post. Her new memoir about covering Iraq is called Tell Them I Didn't Cry. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Jackie Spinner about reporting from Iraq. Also, we discuss how the centrality of Islamic law in Iraq today is affecting women's rights with Isabel Coleman of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Lord Schwartz celebrates the 250th anniversary of the birth of his favorite composer, Mozart. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jackie Spinner. Her new memoir, Tell Them I Didn't Cry, is about covering Iraq for the Washington Post from May 2004 to March 2005. While you were reporting from Iraq, you got your share of nasty emails from readers about, you know, you had an agenda, you were just reporting the negative stories and not the positive stories. Would you talk a little bit about the emails that you got and what effect they had on you?
I think probably the worst email I ever received was from a woman who said, "I wish you had died today instead of that Marine." You know, the ones that accused me of being anti-American were really difficult, or accusing me of having an anti-military bias. And I was confused a lot of the time because, you know, I thought, here I am, I'm risking my life to deliver the news. My mother is, you know, constantly worrying about me here. And yet when I write stories, people don't believe what I'm writing. They don't believe what I'm reporting is accurate. And after a point, you wonder, well, why am I here? Why am I doing this? Why am I assuming this risk if nobody believes what I have to say anyway?
Did you get positive emails?
Very rarely. I think when people are happy with the news, they don't take the time to write as much as they do when they have a visceral reaction to something that you've written. I actually was befriended by a woman from Minnesota. Her son was in the Army. And she wrote me and said, look, I can't publicly defend you. I'm a conservative. You work for The Washington Post, which is has a reputation for being a liberal media outlet. But I want to let you know, thank you for being there. And she and I ended up over the course of time developing a friendship. And she would often write me and tell me to hang in there. And she was thinking about me and hoped that I was staying safe.
There was a time in Iraq when there was actually a price on your head. What was that about?
$5,000. That's what I was worth, I guess, to the insurgents. I had been featured in a newspaper article. A reporter, an Iraqi reporter, had listened in on an off-the-record discussion I was having with members of the Iraqi press about objectivity. The U.S. Embassy had asked me to come and speak on the subject, and I did. And it identified me by name in a newspaper. And a stringer that we have, a former intelligence officer, I used to call him our insurgent liaison because he certainly had contact with the insurgents, which is why we kept him on the payroll. He came and asked if there was a Jackie Spinner who worked for the Washington Post, and our staff said, no, that's not that woman, you know. She goes by a different name. And he basically was telling them that he was being offered $5,000 to let them know my whereabouts. When I returned to Baghdad this fall, when I shook his hand and he was very happy to see me again, I said, hi, my name's Susie. I didn't want him to know my real name. And he said, hello, Jackie Spinner. Welcome back to Iraq.
So he knew and he protected you.
He knew. He knew. He was basically giving us a warning that that the insurgents were looking for me.
You have a twin sister who was, you know, missing you very much and very worried about you while you were gone. And she writes, she contributes some of the writing to your memoir. And I want to quote something that she writes after you returned from Iraq. And she says, during our evening dinners together, my sister drank too much wine, talking angrily and loudly about the morons around us. I tried to hush her, but she lashed out at me, too. When I pointed to her shaking hands wrapped around her third glass of water in 10 minutes, she pushed herself a little farther from the table, farther from me. In the hotel room we shared, she refused the bed, opting to sleep in the closet instead. As the weeks and months wore on, I began to realize that whatever Iraq had given my sister, the war had taken more. Do you agree with that? What goes through your mind reading your sister's perceptions of you when you got home?
Well, it's hard for me to read that and to hear that. It's 100% accurate. I had a very difficult return, certainly the first time I came home. And I know that my family just wanted me to be the same old Jackie who had gone to war, and I'm not. That experience forever has changed me. And it was so difficult for me to come back and to see my family needing me to be in the role of protector and to be the strong one when all I wanted to do was break down. I didn't want to get out of bed in the morning. And I know that it was just so difficult on them, and it still is. I mean, they still want me to be here, and I'm not really here.
She mentioned you were sleeping in the closet in the hotel. Was that where you had to sleep in Iraq, in the closet?
I slept on the floor in Iraq, mostly because my bed was too close to glass, which if there had been a mortar attack, would have sprayed me with all the little sharp splinters. I was more comfortable sleeping on the floor when I came home because it made me feel like I was still in Iraq. When you come home, you don't want to resume your life as it was, because that negates everything that you've been through. It makes the whole experience disappear. The hardest thing for me was coming back and sitting in the same seat, in the same desk in the Washington Post newsroom. People walked by me and said, "Oh, were you gone?" And I wanted to say, "Of course, I just risked my life for this newspaper for 13 months, and I don't want to be back where I started from."
You have a twin sister, and it sounds from the book like there was a long period of your life where, I don't know if inseparable would be the right word, but that connection was one of the strongest things that identified each of you. And you had to see each other every day, and you had to share everything that happened to each of you. So how has this experience affected you as a twin?
I think the hardest thing for my sister Jenny and me to cope with is the fact that it's not possible at all for her to relate to the experience that I've gone through. And I certainly can't relate to the experience that she's gone through, that, you know, that dread that your twin may die, and every day in a persistent dread, and the loneliness that she felt when she could not communicate with me. I would say that our twinship, as we call it, is as strong as ever. I still need my sister. I talk to her at least once, if not, well, probably more like three times a day, every day. And, you know, I could not have gone through that, the experience of being a reporter in Iraq without her. And I don't know how people who don't have twins do it.
Why? What did it give you to have a twin while you were there in Iraq?
I had somebody that I could be perfectly honest with. Even if I were trying to be brave for my editors, and I would be saying to them, "Of course, I'm fine. Everything's great. Yeah, I know I haven't slept in about 3 days, but I'm still going strong." I could call my sister or email her and say to her very honestly, "I don't know how I'm going to get through the next 12 hours. And when I survived the mortar attack on the Sheraton, and I literally thought I was going to die that night, I didn't call my editors and say, "I'm terrified. I almost died." I called my sister, and I was able to talk to her about the fear that had besieged me that night.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for the work that you did in Iraq, for all the risks you took to do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jackie Spinner is a reporter for The Washington Post. Her new memoir about covering Iraq is called Tell Them I Didn't Cry. Coming up, how Islamic law is affecting women's rights in Iraq. We'll talk with Isabel Coleman of the Council on Foreign Relations. This is Fresh Air. The new Iraqi constitution states that no law can be passed that contradicts the established rulings of Islam. Women, Islam, and the New Iraq is the title of an article in the current edition of Foreign Affairs by my guest Isabel Coleman. She directs the Women and U.S. Foreign Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations and is working on a book about how the U.S. can advance the role of women in the Middle East. We invited her to talk with us about how Islamic law, or Sharia, is affecting women's rights in Iraq. You argue that in Islamic states, and Iraq is now one, that it's probably more likely for women to promote equality if they work within the religious context than if they work from the secular context, that like secular women don't really stand a chance in an Iraqi state. So if you hope to work toward equality, do it from a more liberal tradition within Islam.
Secular women in Iraq are incredibly important and have been incredibly important in raising issues, in pushing the thinking, in keeping women's issues forefront on the agenda. But I think if we pin all of our hopes on their ability to push for women's rights within Iraq, we will be disappointed. It's just, I don't think it's politically realistic within Iraq. There was a debate during the drafting of the Constitution over whether Sharia would be in or out of the Constitution, and very clearly, those who wanted it out lost. It's in the Constitution. It's very central to the Constitution, and public opinion in polls in Iraq and in many Muslim countries around the world indicate that the majority of people want Sharia. To assume that you can go in with a secular perspective saying, no, it doesn't belong there, I think is a failing proposition.
The Shia have 48% of the seats in parliament, and the majority of Iranians follow the Shia branch of Islam. So is there reason to think that the Shia in Iraq will want a similar interpretation of laws pertaining to women that the Shia in Iran have put into effect? And if so, what would that mean? What are some of the more restrictive laws in Iran?
Well, I think there is tremendous concern on the part of many Iraqis that is the direction that the country is going in, and that what you're going to have in Iraq is some type of Iranian-inspired theocracy, which would not be very good news, I would say, for women in that country. Right after the Iranian Revolution in 1979, 1980, within sort of 6 or 8 months of the revolution, one of the first things they did is make existing civil law null and void and put new Islamically justified laws in place that, for example, lowered the marriage age to 9. And child custody, you know, was a big point of contention for many women, particularly during the Iran-Iraq War, when fathers were killed and mothers not only lost their husband, but then suddenly lost their children to their dead husband's family, because the children at a certain age are then taken away from the mother and given to the father's family. And these are just two examples of laws that women in Iran found particularly onerous and fought through the legislative system to change, and they have changed them. And this is my point, that what we think of as Islamic law is really a series of laws that somebody has said, well, this is what how we should interpret our laws based on my reading or so-and-so, you know, whoever Islamic scholar's reading of the Quran. And it's changeable, and it does change, and it has changed. But there is concern in Iraq that the very conservative elements in Iran are influencing the situation in Iraq, and it doesn't bode well for women there.
Sharia is Islamic law, but where can we find it exactly? I mean, are there actual laws that are laid out within the Quran?
Well, that's part of the problem, is that Sharia is a body of jurisprudence that has evolved over the millennium. And there have been different Islamic scholars and Islamic jurists who have read the Quran and read the hadiths, the sayings and the doings of the Prophet, and said, okay, from that we can determine that this must hold true or that must hold true. And over the centuries, different schools of Islamic jurisprudence have evolved. And from that, Islamic law has evolved. And there are differences among them. So there's a lot of room for selective interpretation and a lot of room for developing laws that you can claim fit within Sharia. And so it's quite fluid and evolving.
Are women more pressured now to wear a full-body veil than they were under Saddam Hussein? And if so, what's behind that? Is that law now, or is it just pressure?
Yeah, you actually saw an increase in women wearing abayas, wearing Islamic headscarves, wearing Islamic dress throughout the 90s in many parts of the country, particularly the South. I think as Saddam Hussein found his own political base weakened after the first Gulf War, he catered to more conservative elements in society, and this is one of the results. You saw more pressure on women to wear abayas. And certainly since the fall of Saddam Hussein, you've seen it certainly around Iraq for a variety of reasons. One is clearly pressure. You know, I've heard many stories stories of Iraqi women being told they cannot attend classes at the university unless they're fully covered, and they're harassed and hassled in the street if they're not covered. And it's also, frankly, Iraqi women themselves choosing to wear it because it gives them a level of security. They feel like they're targeted if they don't have it, and they just want some anonymity on the street because the situation is so violent and insecure.
The Iraqi constitution says that 25% of the seats in the parliament have to be held by women. So I'm assuming that a minimum of 25% of the people elected to the parliament in Iraq are women. Can we assume that they support women's rights?
No, I don't think we can assume that they support women's rights in the way that you or I probably think of women's rights. The women who have been elected, and I think over 25% of those elected are women, and the way they implemented it was they had a quota, and every third name on the list had to be a woman's name. But it is proportionate to the way that the parties are represented in parliament. So the United Iraqi Alliance, which is the Shiite coalition, they got 48% of the seats, so roughly half of the women in parliament are from that list, from the UIA. And they will toe a pretty conservative line. They will pretty much stay within their party platform. But it's unclear what they're going to do in terms of women's rights. The hope for Iraqi women is that you will see these conservative Shia women trying to find those more progressive interpretations of Islam, of Sharia, to accommodate a more modern role for women within Iraq.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Isabel Coleman is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Her article, Women, Islam, and the New Iraq, is in the current edition of Foreign Affairs. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz helps celebrate the 250th birthday of Mozart. This is Fresh Air. Friday marks the 250th anniversary of Mozart's birth. He was born on January 27, 1756, and died in 1791. Although he lived only 35 years, his name has become synonymous with classical music that still reverberates for modern audiences. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, tells us why he thinks Mozart is the greatest classical composer who ever lived.
No Western composer demonstrated a more Shakespearean range of emotions than Mozart. From the comedy of self-deception to tragic despair. From pleasure in worldly comfort to heroic defiance of convention. From supernatural terrors to spiritual ecstasy. His most ravishing music looks inside the soul about as deeply as art can. Many commentators have pointed out that Mozart's instrumental works, sonatas and chamber music, symphonies and concertos, have such a human, singing voice, they're like operas. And no one composed operas that more subtly explore human nature, intimate relationships, social morality, the conflict between individual will and spiritual imperatives. Even his most cheerful music seems to hide tears. And his greatest tragic opera, Don Giovanni, is also a comedy, It's labeled a drama giocoso, a jokey drama. Maybe we today understand these complex qualities better than Mozart's own contemporaries. I'm thinking of two remarkable movies, for example, that use Mozart as a recurrent underlying theme. Mike Nichols' Closer from 2004 and John Schlesinger's 1971 Sunday Bloody Sunday, both of which are about switching sexual partners. In fact, they use exactly the same music. The sublime little trio from the first act of Mozart's opera Così fan tutte. This trio is actually a prayer. Two sisters believe their lovers are going off to war. Their friend Don Alfonso joins them in wishing the men a safe journey, calm winds and tranquil waves. May every element, they sing, respond benignly to our desire. Suddenly, there's a stab of totally unexpected, almost sour harmony on the word désir, desire. In reality, the two fiancés aren't leaving at all. Don Alfonso has bet them that their girlfriends won't, can't, remain faithful to them. The title of the opera, Così fan tutte, means That's What They All Do. The subtitle is School for Lovers. The guys are going to return in disguise, each pursuing the other's girl. So the trio is really built on deception, the bet, and the self-deception of the girl's self-dramatizing display of excessive emotion. In Peter Sellers' famous production of Così fan tutte, which we just heard, the iconoclastic director literally brings the opera into the modern world, a diner at a seaside resort. On that suddenly bitter harmony in the trio, while the sisters lift up their arms in prayer, Sellers has Alfonso bring his hands down over his eyes. He's hiding his real desire to win his bet, and maybe even his unwitting desire not to prove his cynical point about love. Sellers sees something even more radical in Mozart's music. In Così fan tutte, it's always hard to believe that the two sisters don't see through their lovers' lame disguises. But Sellers suggests that they do see through the disguises, and that pretending to believe the deception gives the women permission to experiment with switching partners. Mozart's insinuating music more than suggests the intense attraction between the new partners. Unlike most productions, Seller's staging actually reflects both the words and the music of the final chorus, about the whirlwind all the characters are still caught up in. Mozart's resolution to the emotional impasse acknowledges that a real resolution is impossible. What more appropriate music could John Schlesinger or Mike Nichols have used in their films? What music could be more profound, more modern in its understanding of human contradictions? And in its sheer beauty, what music could be more sympathetic to our human dilemmas?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Emancipator's Wife, a novel of Mary Todd Lincoln by Barbara Hambly. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Douglas Holtz Aiken. In December, when he resigned from his position as head of the Congressional Budget Office, a Washington Post editorial praised him for resisting political pressure. A New York Times editorial praised him for protecting his agency, which may be the last bastion of neutral government analysis in Washington. Join us for the next Fresh Air.